This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Maybach, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermès, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Hello, and thank you very much for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen. To a certain extent, we're still in the midst of lockdown at the moment, which is changing the way we're doing things. The podcast is normally predicated on the live radio programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland called Out of Doors. We're getting so much comment from folk coming in, it seems a pity not to include that. So, this is what we've been up to this week. And a very good morning to you. Blue skies up there, and there are about half a dozen swifts flying in front of a half moon. There's drama here in the car park at BBC Aberdeen because there's two crows fighting. They've managed to cope the bird feeder off the rowan tree, and they're playing tug of war with it across there, and there's a pigeon just waiting to see if anything falls out that it might be able to wander in and snaffle. It's exciting times, I tell you. I'm Mark Stephen. With me this morning, Mr. Ewan McElraith.
Even more exciting up here because we've got a roe deer just strolling quietly through the barley, which is just changing colour to that yellow colour. But we had fantastic fun yesterday because two squirrels arrived at the squirrel feeder. One got in it. And the other one was trying to get nuts past it, and they were kind of throwing nuts at each other. It was just absolutely delightful. And here in Bamshire, the sun is out as well. It's wonderful. You're always keen to hear about your stories. You know, you're getting out there after lockdown. What are you doing? Where are you going? Lots of people wild camping. I was in Lochlinnie a couple of days ago, and loads of folk getting out there and doing it. Email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. The text number is 80295. Tweet at BBC Outdoors. There's Facebook. There's nowhere to hide. And Lewis is here as well. He's on 0808592 9500.
Coming up, I'm going to be keeping a very respectful distance from what I reckon is an unmissable sight in parts of the countryside at the moment. And we'll be offering you a chance to play your part in the naming some osprey chicks. Have a look on our Facebook page to see a picture of the three youngsters.
And great excitement, the mystery bird returns. Here's a very quick blast as a teaser. More coming up shortly.
See, that's one of my favourite.
And don't worry
in
if you didn't actually get. It's wonderful. I mean, something. People are complaining this is just getting easier and easier, but there's a lot of folk out there don't know what it is, and we're here to educate and inform. But if you do know what it is, 80295 on the text, or email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, and 0808592 9500. And it is a delightful bird.
You notice he said educate and inform. We've given up on entertain. Yeah. It was never working, so just write that one off. Last weekend, I spotted a tweet from Cameron McNeish pointing out the fact that a remarkable woman, Myrtle Simpson, had just celebrated her 90th birthday. Well, Myrtle is recipient of the Polar Medal. She's a skier. In the 1960s, she became the first woman to ski across Greenland, and she's a mountaineer. Now, back in, I think it was 2016, Helen and I went to visit Myrtle at her home near Aviemore. We had a fantastic chat with her. Here she is describing a trip to Peru.
I had a good friend called Billy Wallace, and a lot of our friends were going to the Himalayas at that time. And we thought, you've got to pay, you know, difficult. What about Peru? And Hugh had been in the Antarctic for
three years. This is your husband?
Years. Yes. Hugh said he'd get off the boat on the way back from the Antarctic and meet us in Lima. So we had to have a title, so we called ourselves the Edinburgh Peruvian Expedition. We had a great send-off, and I'd sold the rights to the Edinburgh Evening Times when I was going to, you know, we got hard cash. We wrote to the Mount Everest Foundation, who'd got a fund that you could approach for money if you'd got a good idea. So we got money, bought our tickets and set off another 6 weeks in the boat and met Hugh in Peru. And we decided what mountain we wanted to climb. It was the only one we really knew the name of. And we didn't have any maps or anything. And you can still do that, Peru, and I'm dumbfounded that so many people go to the Himalayas, which are very difficult to get permission, and you've got to know about this, that. You can still go wandering around Peru. So the three of us, you know, set off and climbed our mountain. It was just magic. You can get a train from Lima, and it gets you up into the equivalent of one of the trekking towns in Nepal. There's not miles and miles of foothills and one thing and another. And then you can get a donkey to take your luggage quite easily. And endless mountains, glorious weather. And it's just not the distances. Anyway, we were just, actually, it was the end of our time and we got a week left. And we saw the highest mountain still looking at us, called the Huascarán. We have a picture of it round. I think it's still hanging here. Yeah, that's it. That's the highest mountain in Peru. It's 22,000 feet, and it's called the Huascarán. Uh-huh. And it had been climbed, and funnily enough, the first person to climb it was an American woman called Annie S. Peck. Anyway, we wanted to have a go, and the quickest route for us was to go from the right, mm-hmm. up that slope, you can mm-hmm. see,
yeah.
and then on to the summit. And there's a picture in the kitchen of our highest camp. And the reason I'm struggling in that picture is I couldn't get my crampons off. And we only had one sleeping bag because it was cold and yeah. it much warmer. That's what Nansen did. He used to travel with one sleeping bag, with all his crew in one sleeping bag. Anyway, so the two boys had to sleep with me and my crampons.
You slept with the crampons on?
With the crampons on, I couldn't get them off. Anyway.
How had they frozen on, or just the leather had got hard?
I think the leather had got hard. We didn't use crampons in Scotland at the time. It was considered non-you. Nowadays, you know, I've got granddaughters at uni and climbing like that, and they've all got crampons. Well, infra-dig to have crampons in my day.
So you just,
didn't
trudged.
Do that. Well, you had nails were coming in, dracuni nails. But rubber boots, you know, rubber bites aren't back on. They didn't hit Scotland until the 1960s.
How long have you and Hugh been married?
We got married in 1959. I was trying to do the arithmetic
50,
the other day.
58 years then. 58 years this year it will be.
Is it? Oh, yeah. Great. I might get some prezzies.
58 years this year, and that's a relationship that was founded on you sleeping together while you were wearing crampons.
You could say that.
With another person there.
With Billy. With Billy Wallace there as well.
How do you jump to actually doing polar expeditions?
Well, Hugh and I got married very soon after we came back from Peru, and he didn't actually have a job because he was writing up his thesis. When he'd been in the Antarctic, he went there as a medic, mm-hmm. but he was doing his research. He was very interested in hormones that change under stress, and it was the beginning of people getting interested in that. And he got some money from NASA, it was space stuff. What would happen when people had to live on a different length day? And Hugh said he could find out the answer by taking a party to the Arctic, where it was dark 6 months, light 6 months, and see how their bodies changed to this. So he'd fixed up, well, we'd both fixed up, that we'd go to Spitsbergen, Svalbard. That's an island mm-hmm. north of Norway, and he could camp there. And William Spears Bruce had a hut there. Mm-hmm. There was a Scottish expedition looking for coal.
Oh, right,
in the 1930s, and he left his hut. Uh-huh. So we got permission to use the hut, and then I found there was preggers. Uh-huh. And I was far too selfish to say, oh, darling, you go away, I'll stay at home. And because I'd been
This is music to Helen's ears. You two are kindred spirits.
Well, Helen, I knew from my father being in the army, and also my grandparents had all worked in India, all that Raj stuff. The women and children went too. It was normal. It was just what you did. So it didn't really occur to me. I never thought I'll stay at home. I just did what I thought women and children, we went. I said I'd go too. So our baby was just 6 weeks when we went to Svalbard.
So was your baby born here?
Yes. And I knew the Lapland people, the Laps, mm-hmm. they don't stop. They have to move with the reindeer. Uh-huh. And so what do they do when they have babies? Well, of course, they move along too. I had the baby in a rucksack. In the first village we came to, all the women gathered round while I dug in and pulled out my baby. And they look of horror on their faces. And they rushed and brought a kumsa, which looks like a cradle. We have mm-hmm. it upstairs. And I've just got it back from a current baby. And it's made of birch wood. And it sits on the sledge or in a kayak, as we found. And it's all snug, and it has a little thing over the top with a bit of material. So they go out in the snow or the blizzards, and they just put the baby down. And we found that the kumsa sat very neatly in the front of our canoe.
Just extraordinary. Myrtle Simpson. The whole interview with Myrtle forms this week's Midweek Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is free to download through BBC Sounds. I can't recommend it highly enough. There was a wonderful moment in that, Ewan, where she was talking about skiing across Greenland. And, you know, Helen, as a mother with young children, said to her, you know, and said, you know, didn't it give you, you know, didn't it worry you, you know, as a mother of small children, you know, taking this dangerous expedition? And Myrtle picked it up completely differently and said, no, I couldn't have taken the children too. That would have been quite irresponsible. And you could see Helen just glow. Perfect, absolutely perfect.
But, you know, we've done stuff over the years, a lot of stuff, but you hear people that just take it to an absolutely extraordinary level. You know, we just went to Peru because there's no restrictions, and we just climbed the mountain, and we all slept in one sleeping bag, and not treasuring the idea of sleeping with somebody with crampons on.
No. I'll tell you what Myrtle seemed to be spectacularly good at, because it happened time after time after time. She seemed to have, she was very pally with a whole succession of male climbers that she took along in these expeditions basically to look after her kids. I'm lost in admiration, I was. Still am.
You can't fault the theory, no?
No,
anyway, we give you a wee blast of our mystery bird earlier on, and there was one on the wall beside me right now giving it big licks. But if you weren't fully awake at that point, here's a couple of clues.
I'm trying to tidy up my garage at the moment, which is frankly long overdue, but I'm having to stop every 3 or 4 minutes because, as regular as clockwork, a bird appears with a mouthful of insects, and she, and I'm assuming it's a she, is feeding her chicks in the nest above me. I can see three little faces peeking out. And what she's done is she's hijacked a swallow's nest, that kind of soup bowl shape of mud that's plastered to one of the beams above me. And she's put a roof on it, made out of moss. And you can just see little faces peeking out every now and again. And this bird's getting really annoyed at me. She's giving me a right old look. So I'm going to come outside and just let her get in. Can you hear the swallows up there? Have found another nest, thankfully. But this bird is a real big hitter in the dawn chorus, punching way above its weight. And it's probably one of Britain's most favourite birds. But what is it?
And if you think you know what that is, then give us a call on 08085 92 95 00. Lewis is here, ready to take your calls. And it's not the most difficult one in the world, but give it a go.
Just when you're talking about swallows and things, swallow nests, I was in my hay shed the other day and counted 11 swallow nests. You know, which is great.
Wow.
Love seeing the swallows about the place. Fabulous flyers, but the place is just cluttered in swallow poo. Susan Murkey has been on to say, Ray, the osprey chicks at Loch Arkaig Pine Forest in Loch Arbour, we mentioned them because basically they want folk to vote on names for these three chicks at the moment. Susan says, I've been following them every day, morning, noon and night, since just after they hatch, like many others, and have learned so much about osprey life. Thankfully, nature has been luckily kind to the nest this year based on events in previous years, and I just keep my fingers crossed all goes okay for them when they finally leave. as do we all. Anyway, stay tuned to the programme. This is Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland, and we will tell you how to actually vote on those names and indeed what the names are. Coming up, the delights of rock pooling and the folklore surrounding hares.
This Sporting Life with Tom English.
A podcast of interviews with compelling characters from the world of sport.
Ricky Bear!
See, you were a 3-1 underdog.
That was a change in time in my career. I know once that bell rings, I can set the pace for the first round to the last round.
Hear these conversations and many more.
You met Muhammad Ali for the first time.
1970. He came in as the George Foreman. He said, man, one day you're going to be heavyweight champion of the world.
Subscribe now by searching for This Sporting Life on BBC Sounds.
I cannot pretend to be particularly interested in sport normally, but I listened to the George Foreman edition of that that you just heard at the end there. It's one of the most fascinating podcasts I've ever heard in my life.
I'm kind of with you. I'm not big into sport, but Tom's one of those guys who just makes it interesting. And it's not the sport, it's the stories behind the sport that I really love about it. You know, I'm listening, as you did, to stuff about boxing. I've no interest in boxing whatsoever. Yeah. But, you know, I listened to the whole thing and I just thought it was great.
I mentioned this before, I mean, this is just to encourage you to actually go and listen to this. But basically, he had been heavyweight champion of the world. He had given it up. He had become an evangelical preacher for something like 13, 14 years. He decided he needed to raise money for his own boys' club, so he's going to go back to boxing when he was in his early 40s. He weighed 315 pounds, and within 2 years, he was heavyweight champion of the world again. He is an extraordinary story. It really is. Anyway.
Yeah.
There's hope for us yet. My spots are a bit late. My attention this week has been drawn to, I mean, a really spectacular presence in the countryside. Chances are you've probably got it in your area too. It's fairly common throughout, depending where you live in the country. I'll confess I've never stood this close to one of these things before, and I am nervous, to be honest. This thing's a foreign invader. It's the nearest thing I'm ever likely to encounter to a real triffid. Since 1981, it's actually been against the law to plant one of these things or even to encourage it. So, understandably, I'm going to car canny.
Turn and run. Nothing can stop them. All round every river and canal, their power is growing. Stamp them out. We must destroy them. The infiltrated city.
It came here first nearly 200 years ago from the Caucasus Mountains, southern Russia, Georgia. And it appears in the records at Kew Gardens in 1817. It was just over 10 years later that somebody noticed that it had escaped and it was found growing in the wild. Now, back then, it had a bumbling yokel of a name. It was known as Siberian cow parsnip, and the Victorians adored it. It was hugely prized as an architectural plant. Its seeds were sold in nursery catalogues, where it was advertised as, and I'm quoting directly here, one of the most magnificent plants in the world. Would I argue with that? No, standing here, actually, frankly, I wouldn't. This thing is seriously impressive. And, you know, the one in front of me is probably about 10 feet tall. The flower roundels at the top are about a foot across. The leaves themselves, 2.5 feet. But these plants can get up to 18 feet tall. And because the Victorians were nothing if not generous, you can find it in lots of corners of the world where, frankly, it shouldn't be. Its seeds were deliberately carried to other countries like Norway so that they could enjoy it too. Apparently, across in Norway, it's known as the Tromso palm. This location is absolutely ideal for it because the river runs down through here. Across there is the main Inverurie-Rothie-Norman road. Behind me, less than probably 100 metres, is the main Aberdeen-Inverness railway line. This plant is an ace coloniser. You can see huge drifts of this stuff along dozens of Scottish rivers, the Ure, the Devon and the Kelvin. There used to be one particularly noteworthy colony at the Cunningar Loop on the Clyde, which was described as one of the most remarkable natural history spectacles in Scotland.
Now, just one of these plants can produce 20,000 seeds. Some get blown by the wind. They don't tend to go very far. But because it likes to grow beside rivers, lots of seeds get carried downstream, and they can go miles. The seed will lie dormant across the first winter, and then come spring, they germinate. And they are terribly, terribly determined to live. Scientists reckon that 95% of all seeds will germinate. So of those 20,000 seeds, one plant theoretically could produce over 19,000 plants. Waste no time, they are approaching. Hurry now, we must protect ourselves and find some shelter. Strike by night, they are defenseless. They all need the sun to photosensitize their venom. Still they're invincible. Still they're immune. It is actually a remarkably attractive plant. It's a member of the carrot family. The stem itself is a sort of wine red colour, and then it splits at the top, rather like umbrella spokes, and then you've got these big roundels of flowers. And although I'm being very careful not to touch it at all, the bees and the hornets and the wasps just couldn't care less. They're all over it. Although I have to say, they look slightly dopey, and I wonder if that's a sort of indication of something. This plant had been in the UK for over 150 years before folk realised that it was actually extremely dangerous. And it was back in the 1970s. I can clearly remember news stories at the time about kids playing with it. You know, just the way it's built, instinctively you would break off bits, you would use it as pea shooters, telescopes, pretend swords, anything along those lines. But this thing is phototoxic. You end up with something called phytophotodermatitis. It is stap it full of chemical compounds that, if they get onto your skin, stops your skin being able to protect itself from strong sunlight. It causes really serious burns and scarring. It's not funny in the slightest. Kids, understandably, are particularly sensitive to it. The blistering from contact with this plant can be horrible, and the scarring can last months, if not years. It's resistant to most weed killers, and don't ever, ever, ever try to strim it unless you're wearing full protective clothing, mask, gloves, full protective suit. You would not believe how much damage you can do to yourself vaporising one of these things and then covering yourself in the juice. So this is the cartwheel plant, Siberian cow parsley, Heraclium mantigasianum. It's the giant hogweed, and as the 70s band Genesis told you, don't mess with it. If you're just waking up, this is definitely Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland. I'd just like to apologise for that. That was Genesis there with surely the one and only song about giant hogweed.
Hey, yeah, I've been to your house a few times, and as far as I can remember from looking at your record collection, you've only got Black Sabbath CDs left.
Yeah, no, I just happen to know about that. That's Next Week Hawkwind, or Yes.
Oh, Silver Machine.
Oh, yes. Aye, absolutely. Blue Oyster Cult. Keep going. Well, we could be here all day. The funny thing is, you know, I started thinking about doing this, and I thought, I'm sure there used to be a song somewhere about giant hogweed, and then it came back to me. It's from the Genesis album Nursery Crime. Now, as I said, this is a species of plant that really is pretty risky to get involved with, but not every species, like us, thinks it's as nasty as we do. Joining us to explain more is Karen Muller, who's a project officer with the Scottish Invasive... I knew I was going to get that wrong. Scottish Invasive Species Initiative, based on the Deveron, Eithun and Ewgie catchments. Good morning, Karen. How are you?
I'm good. How are you guys doing?
Not bad at all. You've been running a project involving giant hogweed and sheep. Now, explain that to us.
Well, basically, our project is looking at all these different methods of how we could be combating invasive species in general, but giant hogweed being certainly a key focus for us. And one of that was that This is certainly our first trial. There's other ones around the world that the grazers are interested in eating giant hogweed and are able to do that. And to just see if that is something that we could use in the future and that we could also maybe at some point recommend to others or at least help them learn from our lessons that we've learned.
We spoke probably 3-4 years ago on the upper stretches of the Deveron Cairn, and you were looking at black-faced sheep, as far as I remember. What was special about the black-faced sheep?
Well, I mean, in general, having hairier breeds and darker skin poses less risk for the grazers, though we've actually not had any ill effect on the sheep from the grazing. But that is why we were especially looking at black-faced sheep.
There is a line in the Genesis track that says, you know, basically, you know, wait to dark because they need the sun to photosynthesize their toxins, something along those lines. Is there any logic to that? If you were trying to physically get rid of hogweed without black-faced sheep, would it make more sense to do it at night time?
Well, that is quite an interesting question. I suppose that I believe that as long as the sap has touched your skin, it can still react with the sunlight as soon as the sun comes back up. So,
but if you wash it off in the interim,
if you brush it off really thoroughly, then yeah. But I mean, I would imagine if that was a task for humans, not for grazers, that you would probably have other risks like vegetation, other things that are hiding in the vegetation, and you know, potentially falling over in giant hogweed and things like that. So I probably would still recommend you do it in daylight, but with the proper PPE and protection.
Yeah. I just have this image of Mark with a scythe in the dark and then leaping into the River Deveron to wash it off.
Yeah, I've got
is it just black-faced sheep? Is it just black-faced sheep carn, or would dark, you know, Aberdeen Angus cattle or something like that be equally resistant to it?
I mean, cattle certainly eat it. I see it all the time when I'm going along the riverbanks to control it myself, that when there's areas of hogweed adjacent to cow fields or even in cow fields, they certainly always have been thoroughly grazed. So they certainly seem to have a taste for it as well. And I've certainly not seen any negative effects of them either. And that hogweed is certainly gone.
What other kind of alien plants do you have to deal with along the riverbanks? I mean, we've got a burn at the bottom of our drive, and it is choked at the moment with Himalayan balsam.
Yeah, Himalayan balsam is another one of our species that we're looking at, as well as Japanese knotweed. And then in some areas, we're also working with the American skunk cabbage and white butter burr. And as a mammal, we are also working with the American mink.
It sounds almost like, you know, we've been taken over by so many different species. Well, why is it important to actually try and control them? Or do you just roll over like rhododendron and say, actually, they've won?
Well, I think as long as there's still people around that want to make an effort, I think it's very important that we keep going. And I hope that our project is one of those examples where we're really, really trying to work with the local communities, with the land managers, with landowners, just to try and raise that awareness to upskill people so that hopefully that after our project is gone, we still have a force on the ground that is informed and able and skilled at taking care of invasive species and carry that on so that we don't lose our heritage of our catchments and our completely being choked out by invasive species and the devastating impact that they have. All of these species die back in the winter, leaving riverbanks bare, vulnerable to erosion. That has knock-on effect on fish. So I think it's really important that as long as we can, we do try and put our best foot forward, and we all pull together, especially because this is not something that we alone can do. We need all the help that we can get. And I think that is a really important thing to consider.
Yeah. Karen, thank you very much for joining us this morning. That's been very kind of you. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much. Have a nice day.
Same to you. Bye. Karen Muller there from the Scottish Invasive Species Initiative based on the Deveron, Eithun and Ugie catchment area. It must be kind of conflicting, though, because I mean, I was standing on the railway bridge looking just at this. You know, there's a huge drift of giant hogweed just beside the river there, Ewan. And it's bonny. You know, it's actually really quite eye-catching.
Yeah, but there's an awful lot of it. I mean, the Karen and her guys are working really hard to get rid of it. But I don't know if it was a result of not lockdown or whatever. There seems to be much more of it than ever. And certainly the little burn beside me, suddenly it started sprouting up. It's lovely, but it's just nasty stuff. And there's so many invasive species out there. Later on in the programme, we're going to be talking about hares. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realise that the only native Scottish hare is the one in the mountaintops. The Romans, or possibly the Celts, brought in the brown hare. And, you know, that's an invasive species that's really succeeded, like the rabbit.
Yeah. But just to reiterate about the giant hogweed, keep away from it. Seriously, it's, you know, you can go online and you can see photographs of the damage that people have done to themselves with the plant. It is not funny. Just a cack annie. Just time
yeah,
to know.
A mystery bird this week. Yeah, let's have a wee blast of this and see. A lot of you know what it is, but let's have a wee listen. I suppose it would be a bit hard here because that's chirruping. That's not the song you would normally recognise it. But give us a text, 80295.
That, I would say, was a sort of slightly anxious version of this particular bird.
Angry.
Yeah, it's, you know, they do definitely scold you. You know, that's, but then again, we were talking about swallows earlier, and they do exactly the same thing. You know, if I find myself in the stables on the Hayshed or something like that, and they want to get in, they'd really kick up stink. Coming up, I'm going to be going on the hunt for something very, 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 very small. And we'll also tell you how to take part in a vote to name osprey chicks at Loch Arkaig. And any ideas what this bird is?
So if you know what that is, get in touch. I'm going to give you a wee clue here. That's its kind of angry, get out of my way type of noise. It has a beautiful, beautiful song. It is an absolute delight to listen to. So if you know, you can tweet at BBC Out of Doors, get in touch, have a look at Facebook pages. Lewis is also here, he's taking your calls. I think there's quite a lot of them. He's on 08 085 92 95 00.
Alison in Dunecht has got it
well,
right. John in Elgin has not. He reckons it was a robin. Sue Hurd has got it right and then said, very happy as red squirrels in garden again. New whippet puppy, Festy, was blamed for cutting through fleece and removing all the ripe strawberries and taking all the raspberries. Their neighbour complained he had lost all these strawberries, but we've seen two red squirrels on the fence. So I think we know who the culprit is there. Ian says he heard the George Foreman podcast, that's This Sporting Life, after your recommendation, thoroughly enjoyed it. Douglas Darkey has got this right and then goes on to say, early morning Genesis 2 with Return of the Giant Hogweed, Brill. Entertaining as always, keep up the good work, along with the Scotsman crossword, makes my Saturday morning's perfect. Well, it's nice to know what you're lumped in with, isn't it? Chris Murray in
Edinburgh. There's a whole potential... Oh, sorry, I was interrupting there. There's a whole potential for Brian Burnett to do a whole programme on invasive species.
Don't know, that's a thought. That is a thought. Not necessarily invasive species, possibly music to do with plants. Don't see why not. There's possibly something to do there. Chris Murray in Edinburgh. This week, I'm going to guess at a skylark. Nope. But I'm now doubting myself after Ewan's clue. He says he's off to climb Benaglow for his first outing after lockdown. Can he wait? Last up there in 1998. Probably pretty similar, I would have thought. But still be good to see those hills again. Loving the show as ever. And this is odd. David from Letterfern says, for years I've collected mussels from the rocks on the northwest shore of Loch Doel and Kintail. This year, there were a very few old ones, but no young ones. Also, no mussels on the risers of our boat moorings. What's happening? I haven't the faintest idea, David, but if you know, give us a call. 08085 92 95 00. I was waiting for you to jump in there with all the relevant information, but you obviously can't be bothered.
Yeah, I was kind of drifting off there. I was just looking. I was actually looking at a blue tit going in and out of the tree there. It's just so much going on.
Right, let's move on to a different species altogether. They have been known to cover the ground at speeds exceeding 40 miles an hour. And are the Mad Hatter's companion at tea parties. We're talking about the hare, and Ewan's been delving into some of the folklore surrounding them.
The night of the full moon. Shadows are cast as the watery, silvery light penetrates the dark of the forest. Shapes change, forms move, the wood is alive with the smell of fear. A shot rings out.
and the dark body of a hare shrieks as it is wounded in the leg. It pauses, then runs despite the pain, because a worse fate awaits it if it falters. The fastest animal in our land takes a pace that no man or dog can match, despite the serious injury. It melts into the darkness. And so goes many a tale involving the hare being shot, and the next day a woman is noticed limping with a bullet in her leg. A witch shot as she took the form of a hare to go about her evil way. It's a story that can be found around the globe, inspired by the awe at which we see in the hare. Since man first looked to the skies, the shape of the hare was the first thing to be seen on the moon. Although to see it properly in Scotland, you have to tilt your head 90 degrees. And in Celtic legend, the hare is thought to have been the origin of the Easter Bunny, when the moon hare laid eggs for good children to celebrate the feast of the goddess Ishtore, Easter. And in Egypt, the ancients carved, painted and engraved images of hares onto jewellery and walls as a sure sign of high fertility. And the dramatic form of the goddess Wenet is depicted as a slim female with the head of a hare to show swiftness. But others look on the hare with other eyes. The clubs of London still serve jugged hare, the recipe for which I'll spare you. But they have been hunted for sport and food since man was on this earth. A fact despised by Robbie Burns in his poem, The Wounded Hare.
Inhuman man, curse on thy barbarous earth, and blasted be thy murder-aiming eye. May never pity soothe thee with a sigh, nor ever pleasure glad thy cruel heart. Go live, poor wanderer of the wood and field, the bitter little that of life remains. No more the thickening brakes and verdant plains to thee shall home or food or pastime yield. Seek, mangled wretch, some place of wonted rest. No more of rest, but now thy dying bed. The sheltering rushes whistling o'er thy head, the cold earth with thy bloody bosom pressed. Oft as by winding nith I, musing, wait the sober eve or hail the cheerful dawn, I'll miss thee sporting o'er the dewy lawn, and curse the ruffian's aim, and mourn thy hapless fate.
There's two types of hare in Scotland. Experts disagree whether it was the Celts or the Romans that introduced the brown hare, but whoever it was, the hares loved it here and were hugely successful, pushing the native Scottish hare out of the lowlands and the forests up into the mountains and moorland, where they survive to this day. Scotland's Parliament voted for protection of our mountain hares, and who knows what the future holds. But in Ireland, they thrive and can be seen in large groups romping in the fields and even on the seashore, where they like nothing better than a meal of seaweed. The Scottish mountain hare in the future may not just be an animal for the high tops.
Scottish hare there. Expand on that for me, that, you know, the contrast between the habitats of hares in Ireland and the ones here in Scotland.
Well, yeah, the Irish hare is the same as the Scottish mountain hare, but the brown hare that was introduced really took off here and chased them up to the high tops. In Ireland, they didn't.
And so this Irish here is widespread from the mountains down to the sea. It's everywhere. And it was just a theory, and we welcome comments on this, that there's a big fluctuations in numbers on the mountains in Scotland. But as the numbers increase, perhaps if they're not culled, they might migrate back down the mountains and re-establish territories throughout the Scottish countryside where they're supposed to be.
Yeah. Be interesting to see if that actually worked. You know, last time I saw big populations of them, it was near Tom and Towel. And it's, you know, again, wintertime, light going down in the afternoon, and it's just these streaks of white heading straight up the hill. You know, because there should have been snow cover, but there wasn't in that particular time. So they're going up against fairly sort of dark heather and bracken and things. But how I would love to be able to get up a hill as fast as I hear.
Yeah, but there's something about them, because the Scottish hare is a gregarious animal, and you see them in big groups just hovering a ball, whereas the brown hare, the introduced species, the invasive species, is pretty solitary. So potentially we could see a big change in our countryside. If you've got thoughts on that, 0808 592 95 00.
Don't know about witches, but they always look wise to me, you know, sort of sitting up in long grass and things, and you know, the dark tips to their ears and things, and they've got these really luminous eyes. Anyway, earlier this week, I took myself off back down to the beach. And basically what I wanted to see, and I don't know how successful I was, I wanted to see if I could find something very, very, very small. I'll be honest, I've forgotten how fascinating this was. I'm sitting beside a rock pool just to the south of the village of Colliston in Aberdeenshire. And despite the fact that the beach is absolutely hoaching across there because it's the school holidays, I'm sitting in the rocks about 200 metres away, and there's nobody here but me. The rocks are quite dark, you know, striated. They're all tipped up to about 30 degrees. So it goes from black, the tidal areas, up to sort of quite a warm grey, sort of fawny grey. And then you get streaks of this mustard-coloured lichen, and right at the top there, the sea pink's thrift, up against a blue sky. And the pool in front of me is not big, this is tidal. Probably no more than about 2-3 feet deep, and regular listeners will not be surprised to hear that I've already stuck my foot in there by accident. But it's just like an underwater garden. Lots of colour, lots of life. Greens, khakis, browns, buff, pink. There's three sea anemones over there that are almost scarlet, none of them bigger than a 50 pence piece. But what I'm actually here to try and find is even smaller than that. Plankton. Now, I know that plankton is microscopic. So I've come prepared. I've got an old hand lens, which might help a wee bit, and probably even more laughable than that, I've got a microscope with me. It's an old one. It came out of Inverurie Academy. I need the microscope because plankton is tiny, but there's an awful lot of it. 10,000 formally described species, but scientists reckon there could be 10 times as many out there. Much of it is microscopic, and yet it makes up 90% of the mass of all marine life in the oceans, and it's the very base of the food chain. If you take plankton out of the equation, everything dies, even us. There's two main types of plankton. Phytoplankton, which is plant-based, they make their energy just like land-based plants do, using chlorophyll and sunlight. They take in carbon dioxide and they release oxygen. Now, they account for about half the photosynthesis on the planet. They are major oxygen producers, which is why I said, if they die, we die. Zooplankton, as the name suggests, are tiny animals. The defining characteristic of plankton is that it lives in open water, and it's got little, if any, control over where it goes. The word comes from the Greek planktos, meaning drifter. Interestingly, despite the size, jellyfish and ocean sunfish are both defined as plankton precisely because they're such incredibly poor swimmers. Zooplankton are divided into temporary and permanent critters. The temporary tend to be the larval stages of adults living on the seashore, things like clams or mussels, oysters, barnacles, crabs, that kind of thing. Plankton is a food source. You remember that old rhyme? Big fleas have little fleas upon their backs to bite them. Little fleas have littler fleas, and so ad infinitum. Stand that on its head, and you've got the whole point of plankton. Zooplankton is eaten by other zooplankton, by shellfish, by fish. And when it comes in the form of krill, which is a bit bigger, it sustains the biggest animal on the planet, the blue whale. A blue whale can eat a staggering
4 tons of zooplankton at a sitting. Bearing in mind these things are very, very tiny, that's a lot. Zooplankton gets everywhere and it becomes trapped in rock pools, which is why I'm sitting here, and it's why I'm hopeful of actually being able to find some. To do this properly, you need a really fine mesh net with a built-in specimen jar at the cod end. Needless to say, I don't have one, so I'm going to rely on dumb luck, and in the initial stages anyway, the Mark I jam jar. I've got one sitting beside me here. So the first thing I'll do is I'll empty this out and then fill it up again. Now, I haven't just gotten into this half-cocked, you know. I went through the glass recycling box and found a jam jar with a flat side. And I've got really quite a good hand lens. I don't know what the magnification is in this, but it's fairly hefty. If I hold it up to the light, and then I have a shifty... There is stuff in there. And it is floating about. I tell you what is alarming, actually. There seems to be quite a lot of almost like little threads. And I suspect that's plastic. But every so often you do see something which is kind of running against the drift. And something's got a bit of colour to it as well. Although, again, that might be plastic. It's hard to tell. OK, the hand lens, I'm afraid, is only going to tell me so much. And I'm going to have to fiddle around here because... As I said, the rock is shelving at 30 degrees. There isn't a flat surface to put a microscope up on, so I'm going to have to balance it on my knee, which, along with balancing the water and the microphone, might take me a wee while. Just bear with me for a second. Right. I cannot begin to describe to you how awkward this is, but never mind. I've got, it's the old-fashioned type of microscope, this, so you can need to, it's got a mirror on a gimbal underneath the lens at the bottom. So you can need to shuffle that about until you get maximum daylight coming back up through it. And I'm coming down into it. I've got just one. It's like, it's a bit like a slater, longer and thinner. Sorry, woodlouse. Got two antennae trailing backwards from the front end, I think it is. And other than that, I have no idea what that is. Yet again, scientific curiosity will only take you so far, and after that, you really need to find somebody who actually knows something about this. It would be nice to know, if you had the right kit and the right gear and the knowledge, what could I find in here?
Well, we've got somebody who's definitely got the right knowledge on the line now. Chris Rickard is from Macduff Aquarium. Good morning, Chris. How are you?
Good morning. I'm fine, thank you very much. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Very well. I was on the hunt for zooplankton there. I said, well, you know, I think I saw something that probably fits the category, but I'm not entirely certain. What can you actually spot if you go down to the rock pools at the moment, supposing you haven't got a microscope, with the naked eye?
Well, as you said in your piece there, that most plankton is microscopic, so you do need a microscope to see it. Mm-hmm. However, there are some much larger species, once again, as you've already said, jellyfish, and of course the sunfish, the largest bony fish in the world, is actually also classed as plankton. So if you're very, very lucky, I doubt you'll actually see one in a rock pool, but we do get sunfish around the UK. So if you ever see one, if you're out in a boat, usually that's when you see the most, but sometimes off a harbour wall, for instance, you might see yourself a sunfish, and then you can definitely see that you've seen plankton. For most of us, it's going to be the microscopic or the smaller stuff. Now, you mentioned an animal there that I think I possibly know what it was. You said it was long and thin, a bit like a slater, a woodlouse, with two sort of trailing antennae. Well, that sounds very much like an isopod. Now, there are hundreds of species. There is no way I could tell you which species it would be, but that's definitely the sort of thing that you're likely to find down on the shore. As you said, there's just so much plankton out there, and it's just so important for life on Earth, let alone life in the sea. So, I mean, it's just a really incredibly important type of animal. So you're going to see some. The better the lens you can have,
the more chance you've got of seeing them. But there are lots you can see with the naked eye. Just the majority is of plankton is smaller.
Are some beaches that are better than others? Because I spent a delightful half hour just looking at hermit crabs in rocky pools, you know, jumping between shells. Well, once you get into it, it's just, you can spend hours just looking at one wee rocky pool.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm always extolling the virtues of going down to the beach. And most people, when they think of going to the beach, they think of the golden sands, you know. I mean, for me, it's Banff Links. That's the closest nice beach. And, of course, that's where a lot of the locals go. But sand isn't that great for life. Now, don't get me wrong, there's a lot of life there. But for looking for the larger types of animals, the bigger spread of species, you're wanting rocky shores. So you're wanting some bedrock in there, you're wanting some boulders, some areas that can form puddles when the tide goes out, and that is literally the definition of a rock pool, and those are the best. I love rock pooling. I take my boys down rock pooling as often as I can, and it's just such a nice activity. Like you just said, you can spend an hour without even thinking about it, and in fact, quite often it's difficult to get the boys to come away. My tips are take a bucket, because you never know what you're going to find. Take a wee net, even wear a pair of gloves if you've got some. Marigolds would work fine, just to protect your fingers. There's a lot of sharp things down there, like barnacles, etc. But yeah, just an amazing habitat to go and explore. There's just so much life.
But there's some brilliant things out. I was looking down from my boat in White Hills Marina, and there was a starfish that was almost 20 inches across. It was massive. But there's also other strange things. We're looking at hares later on in the programme, but you're talking about a thing called a sea hare, which I've no idea what that is.
Ah, right, yeah. Well, sea hares are an interesting animal. I mean, I am a keen scuba diver, so I spend a lot of my time underwater. I've done something like 1,300 dives, mostly around Scotland. So I've seen a lot of animals. But yeah, my favourite type of animal, I think I've got to say, are nudibranchs. Have you got any idea what I'm talking about if I say that?
Nope, none at all.
Right, okay.
No, honest is the best policy, lad.
Okay, fair enough. So yeah, a nudibranch, which literally in Latin means naked gill. Basically, it's sea slugs, which you probably have heard of. Mm-hmm. Sea slugs are very, very common. You find them all around Britain, well, all around the world, as far as I'm aware. But there are hundreds of species, and they're incredibly, incredibly beautiful animals. They're really colour variable, they're really shape variable. Some of them are incredibly cryptic. In other words, they blend into whatever their food or their surroundings are. And actually, sea hares are very closely related to nudibranchs. Now, they don't actually have a naked gill, so they're not nudibranchs, but they are opistobranchs, which is the family of the nudibranchs come under. And sea hares, once again, they're quite common. There's a few species of them. But right at the moment, actually, sort of early summer, like we're in just now, and you wouldn't know it with the weather the last few days, but sea hares are quite often found in rock pools, literally, and they can get large. I'm talking 5, maybe even 6 inches long. The majority will be smaller, but they look like jelly, rubbery, leathery, brown splodges is the best way to describe them. If you see them in the water, they can spread themselves out. They've got two long antennae-looking things that come off the top of their head. They do have a very small shell, so they are actually members of the mollusca. They are a shellfish, but their shell is internal for the most part, so it's literally covered by their body. Sometimes you can actually glimpse it, but they are amazing things, and actually they're one of the things that to look out for in the rock pools because they are so amazing. And if you very carefully pick one up and pop it in a bucket with some salt water in there, if you're lucky, he will expel, a bit like inking in an octopus, he will expel some very, very bright purple liquid, and that's his defence mechanism. Now, obviously, you shouldn't go around poking these willy-nilly and trying to get to defend themselves. However, it does happen, and the colour that comes out of them is utterly amazing. It's like iodine. If you remember dropping a couple of drops of iodine into water or whatever when you were at school doing science, and the colour that goes, that's the sort of colour that sea hares can produce. And they're amazing animals. And they feed on quite high up the shore, so they will get caught in rock pools. They feed on things like green algae, which grow quite high up the shore, so that's why you're likely to see them. And that's just one. That's just one species that you find down in the rock pools. You never know what you're going to find. It's an amazing place.
See, Chris, I just love talking to folk like you because, you know, the enthusiasm in your voice is just shining out of it at the moment. And the fact is that, you know, there are wonders of nature there, and literally they are feet away from us if we only choose to look.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, that's one of the things about being a scuba diver. The animals and species that I see underwater, and the plants, but mostly the animals, you know, people, dry people, on land people,
generally have no idea. And, you know, people can live on the coast, splashing in the water their whole lives and have no idea what's just a few feet below them in the water. And it makes me sad that sometimes you get kids coming around the Macduff Aquarium that are, you know, coming from traditionally sea ports, you know, sea towns, and they're like, oh, we've never done rock pooling. And it's just, it's really sad because it's such a rich environment for learning, you know, and it doesn't have to be all learning, but it's fun as well because it's just amazing. So, yeah, I mean, my boys, they're lucky. They've got me to take them down, and my wife as well. And we go down as often as we can and do a bit of rock pooling and obviously the usual things of throwing stones in the water and digging holes. But, you know, we do a lot of life learning about life when we're down there as well. So, just really lucky to live in the northeast of Scotland. We've got such a rich load of animals down there. So, yeah, just love it. I just love it.
Macduff Aquarium's not open at the moment for obvious reasons, but I would imagine you will be hoping to open soon.
Yes. Obviously, we're following government advice, but also then the Scottish Government, and then also Aberdeenshire Council, because we're run by Aberdeenshire Council. So we're hopeful end of July sometime. We can't get a date just now, but yeah, I mean, the staff have been in, skeleton staff, you know, two or three people in at a time throughout the whole of the lockdown. So we're lucky we've still had our jobs to go to and keep us sane during lockdown. And obviously all the animals still need looked after, all the plant machinery still needs to be running correctly, etc., and checked every day. So yeah, there's been lots to do. But yeah, we're hoping to open to maybe 3 weeks, but we just have to wait and see. So no fixed date yet, but you can obviously check on our website when you need to and see, or give us a phone. There's usually somebody in and we'll be able to tell you our proper opening times.
We'll look forward to that time. Chris, thank you for joining us this morning. That was kind of you.
No worries at all. Thank you very much indeed. Cheers.
Chris Rickard there from Macduff Aquarium. And as I said, you know, you can join in with heaps of online activities even with it being shut at the moment, and there's a link to their website from ours.
Yeah, but when it does open, I know it's in the northeast of Scotland, but it is such a fantastic resource. Yeah. You know, the fish are amazing, but what they do have are little touchy-feely rock pools where you can see all that kind of stuff going on that he was talking about and get enthused and then take that knowledge, and it's right there on your doorstep. It's, you know, 20 yards from the grass, you're in a whole new world. It's fascinating.
Do you know what I've always fancied doing? I've never got the chance to do it, but I've always fancied actually going down into one of the pools, you know, with scuba gear, you know, and actually having the cod swimming past you and all that kind of thing. Be good fun.
Well, we can set something up for you to go swimming with sharks.
And I've done that. did that at the aquarium in North Queensferry. That's fantastic, you know, with the tiger sharks. Really enjoyed that. But no, just to be able to do it with native species, I think I would enjoy that. Anyway, we've several comments coming in. Margaret in Aberdeenshire guessed correctly as to the mystery bird, saying we had one nest in the strawberry net few years ago. This year hijacked the swallow's nest. She says, we got rid of giant hogweed in our burn with Roundup. Well done for bringing it to attention. Enjoy the programme. Yeah, again, this is not a criticism, Margaret, but I'm not sure you should be using Roundup in a burn. Dennis Grattan in Buxburn says, the first encounter with giant hogweed was while salmon fishing at Rothie May. Fortunately, it was raining and I had my fishing jacket on, but still managed to get some nasty burns on my wrists, pushing it aside. You're quite correct to warn folk of this nasty plant. Anyway, more comments coming up shortly. Our lockdown exercise this week comes to us courtesy of folk musician Anna Massey. Now, Anna found herself in a location she didn't quite expect to be spending so much time in.
On the 17th of March, I drove from Glasgow up to Fortrose on the Black Isle to visit my mum and dad for a few days. And what an eventful few days they turned out to be, with lockdown being announced and all of the work in my diary for the next few months disappearing as gigs and festivals throughout the summer were postponed or cancelled. When faced with the choice of going back down to Glasgow or spending lockdown here in the Black Isle, I chose the latter, and a large part of that decision was Mum and Dad's delightful black Labradors, Sonny and MacPhail, who are named after characters in Neil Munro's Parahandy tales. As you can imagine, they need a lot of exercise, and when lockdown was at its tightest and we were only allowed out for an hour a day per person, this is when the dogs got their walks. Now they're back up to about 4 or 5 walks a day. And whether it's a short stretch of the legs just before bedtime or an all-afternoon hike, along to the caves at the end of Rosmarkie Beach. They are always delighted to hear the rustle of an anorak at the front door or the slap of the sole of a wellie or hiking boot in the porch. Today, our walk is taking us from Fartrose Harbour along the beach out to Shannonmoe Point. Thomas Telford, the mastermind behind the Caledonian Canal, designed three harbours here in the Black Isle, at Cromartie, Auch and Fartrose. The one that we can see just along the coast in Auch is the biggest of the three and was, until fairly recently, still a functioning fishing port. In fact, a lot of the Scottish herring fleet landed here, including my grandad Peter Buchan. From the harbour in Fartrose, we can see along past the fisher village of Auch, you can see the opening of Munlochie Bay, and then there's the Keswick Bridge with Inverness behind it, the town which continues to sprawl out and grow into the hills on either side of it. On a clear day, the view from here out over the hills behind Inverness and down towards Nairnshire is absolutely glorious. If a har rolls in, you've got no chance of seeing anything. Today, it's pretty breezy, fairly overcast. The firth's quite choppy and the tide is on its way in. The dogs and I have had some really beautiful walks down here on some of the lovely, flat, calm summer evenings we've enjoyed earlier in the season. The beach down this side of Shannonmoe Ness is pretty stony and can be kind of hard going underfoot. But once you turn the corner at Shannonmoe Point, things get really sandy as you head towards Rosmarkie. Our walk down to the point, as it's known locally, takes us down the side of Fartrose and Rosmarkie golf course. So you've really got to keep your wits about you for any shouts of four if things go agley on the golf course. When you get to the point, there's quite a lot to take in. This is where Conyahore, the Bran Seer, was burnt to death in a barrel of tar. This is also the first place I ever tried busking. When I was about 12, I stood beside the Bran Seer's monument, scraping away on my fiddle for the tourists who'd come to have a look at the stone and see if they could catch a glimpse of the famous Murray Firth bottlenose dolphins. It wasn't a hugely successful day. There were quite a few lessons learnt that day, I'd say. Just behind the Bran Seer stone, there's another Telford-designed pier, a ferry pier that used to take goods and passengers over to Ardrossier on the other side of the Firth, which is right beside Fort George. The fort was completed long after the 1746 Jacobite uprising and is still a working army base now. Although it's never fired a shot in anger, on a clear day, you can hear the soldiers on the firing range and it sounds like popcorn across the Firth. The crowning, shining glory of Shannonmoe Point is the Alan Stevenson Lighthouse, which has stood there since 1846. It's been automated for decades now, but still shines every night to warn the sailors coming in from the Murray Firth. The walk to Shannonmoe Point has been a near daily occurrence for me during lockdown life on the Black Isle, although I'd say it's a pretty safe bet that if it hadn't been for the dogs, I wouldn't have gone quite so far on some of the rainier days.
Folk musician Anna Massey there speaking and playing, and you can catch Anna on BBC Radio Scotland on Thursday evenings when she presents Travelling Folk from 8 o'clock onwards.
That was fantastic. I could listen to Anna all day. I mean, so much information, so much enthusiasm, and chucking in her own music as well. I mean, how good is that?
I had no idea that her grandfather was Peter Buchan, you know, who was a skipper from Peterhead and, you know, wrote several excellent books. Interesting. You're listening to Out of Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElraith. If you miss any of this, there are umpteen ways of listening again.
You can catch up whenever you like by looking up the programme on BBC Sounds.
Or you can download the free Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is available from BBC Sounds. We always ask you every week, you know, tell us where you actually listen to the podcasts. Email us your stories at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, which is what Lynn Sorrentino from Geneva did. And she says, "Hi, Mark and Ewan. When I wrote you on the 26th of December, I was mid-chemo. Now I've finished chemo, surgery and radiation, and I am cured of breast cancer," which is excellent news.
Yeah, absolutely. And she goes on to say, "I've been walking throughout the pandemic all round Geneva, and on the 7th of May was able to record a cuckoo bird. They're rare here in Geneva, so this is really special. I'm thankful for your show, as it's really helped me through all of my treatments and given me something to look forward to. Thank you."
Now, our archive piece this week is, well, I'll be honest, it's quite a recent one, but it goes right back to a way of life that certainly I wasn't aware of.
This is fantastic, trust me. In December last year, we, Mark and I, both celebrated the centenary of the Forestry Commission. And for that programme, I had the real pleasure to speak to woodcutters Charlie and Gordon Smith from Huntly. Now, Charlie's in his early 90s and his brother Gordon is late 80s. And they started working in the woods in the late 1940s, carrying on from their father. And I asked Gordon first what his father did then.
Well, he was a carter in the wood, horse carter. Well, eventually it comes to tractors and caterpillars and so forth, right on.
And there was portable sawmills, is that right? How did that work?
Well, it was just a tractor and a single bench, and that was it, mining timber.
So when you were young, your dad was moving round, was he?
He would have carted in to the sawmills with a horse and buggy.
So you're all living there, you're going to school. What happens when the cutting's finished?
I was shifted around, you see, it's portable sawmills. Well, you just had another sawmill to get it, portable.
You moved house and a whole lot moved, wooden house.
Well, so you took the house with you?
The house went with you.
Mm-hmm. So how did that, was that quite easily collapsible?
They're very good, fine, while sitting outside until the house was kind of set up for the night.
Well, I remember once shifting Fairboyne to Dremuir the same day with a lorry, yeah. And my mother was making a supper at 5 o'clock.
That's what you did, and that was it.
So you were never in the same place for more than what?
No, well, he went to Nathy School for stuff, but I was never at Nathy School, but I went to school at Aboyne, Dremuir, and Course, and Lumphanan. That was different schools that I went to.
That must have been quite difficult as you were young, going to a new school.
Well, we better got used to it.
Was a lot of people on the same boat?
No. Yes, well, take for instance Dremuir, where at the sawmill you go had three timber merchants alone in that district. Jones had two mills, Riddick had one, and Lockhart had two. And that's only in the size of Dremuir. Riddick's, when they were up at Tullybeg and Dremuir, they were all in, it was no, almost a street, timber houses. Well, there'd be a married couple in one house, probably a single chap and a bothy in the next one, then another Murray. And it was a good half mile houses, just in, for one sawmill.
So would these all be all portable houses?
Aye, all portable. And they were known as Riddick sheds because they had the slope of roof, nail the peak of roof.
Kind of a mini village.
Yeah, just a mini village. One of the teachers that I had at school referred to us as the barbarians from the woods.
Well, it must have been quite interesting when the whole circus rolled into town.
There was
21 huts, weren't there?
Something like that.
Something like that.
It must have been quite a community.
Yeah, it's a good long road.
No running water, no electric lights, no.
What was it like? I mean, talk me through what that portable house was like inside.
You yes. Well, there was four brothers us, and my mother had the heat flask for 8 flasks in the morning. I think she was up at the back at 5 o'clock in the morning.
Presumably you're not
started at 7.
Presumably you're not all getting a bedroom each.
No.
So how many were sharing the bedroom?
Three. There was four brothers, but there was three coming up at the same time, more or less. Four brothers and we've had 50 years at sawmills.
Going back to the house, how did it all fit together? How did it work?
Just boards. sections together. Just
what, pegged together, or how was that?
It's just simple. Just in sections, and that was it.
So would your dad have made that?
No. They were all made. Nah, yeah. Mm-hmm. My mother and that used to try and paper mine the inside of them, but it was old, rough wood, and when the summertime hot weather came, the cracks appeared and up and down.
So your mother's trying to paper it to keep the wind out.
Exactly. But drinking water had to be carried probably... You was lucky if you got drinking water out of a well about 200 to 300 yards away.
What was your first job?
My first job, I left the school at 13 and a half. I got an exemption at 13 and a half. And I started at Jones.
So what was your job?
Picking planks off the end of the saw. But there's lots of shorties before that.
Well, you're presumably doing work in the bulk of the time when you were at school as well.
Yes. When the summer holidays came, you always had the jobs, and we used to, James Jones, the poles, you know, your electric poles and your telephone poles, we used to peel them in our holidays. That was a job. I think we've got about 3 old pennies each for it.
So you're living quite a migrant life for a fair chunk of your childhood.
Just...
So when did you finally get a permanent house?
Oof. No.
Neither was married.
No, I too was married in 1958.
That must have been quite exciting as well.
Aye.
It must have been quite a unique upbringing. You look back at it fondly because... It must have been quite hard in the winter.
It was hard. I think one of the winters back in 1940-41, when I was up at Goshney, I think it was 2 months, I never seen school. We had to go to course school, which was further, about 3 mile. We walked through fields and never had to go to school.
Must be a happy memory, though.
Charlie and Gordon Smith, absolutely fascinating tale of portable houses and a lifetime in the woods. Extraordinary, Ewan.
No, incredible. I was just enthralled. I mean, delightful accents. And just, you know, you could see the smiles and the faces who were reliving that. But the thing that I really took away from that interview was, it wasn't in that section, was when the war happened and they joined up. And most people... You know, they suddenly, you know, they're square bashing, they're doing training and they lose weight. Gordon actually put on weight when he joined the army because he was so fit. Yeah. I think he said 3/4 of a stone they put on. Incredible.
Yeah, just. Anyway, we checked up and Charlie and Gordon are still both in extremely fine fettle. But if you've any, you know, suggestions for stuff that we've done in the past that you'd like to hear again, good or bad, let us know and we'll do our best to search our archive to find them. Scotland, as you know, we've had long association with ospreys, and advances in technology over the years means that we're able to get a close-up view via webcams of life in osprey nests. Now, causing a bit of an online sensation this year, are 3 5-week-old osprey chicks in a nest near Loch Arkaig in Lochaber. So much so that the Woodland Trust Scotland, who actually own the pine forest, have asked the public to suggest names for the 3 chicks. Now, they're likely to be 2 males and a female. George Anderson for the Woodland Trust joins us now. Hello, George. How are you doing?
Morning, very well, thank you.
Glad I am to hear it. You have received a heap of suggestions for the youngsters, you know, names for the youngsters. What happens now?
Well, over the week we had about 3,000 suggestions coming from various directions, so it's been quite a challenge boiling it down. So what we've done is we've grouped them in 3, so we thought rather than having individual votes on each bird, we've grouped the names in 3 and we're offering 4 choices. And an online vote the deadline is 8 o'clock on Sunday night, so you can vote this weekend through our social media channels and through our website on the Osprey page. And I can now exclusively reveal, I could exclusively reveal the finalists, and they are Doddy, Vera, and Captain, and that's to honour Doddy Weir, Vera Lynn, and Captain Tom.
Yep. Okay.
Ali Bally and B, of Coulter's Candy fame. An awful lot of Celtic mythology and Norse mythology, so the other two are Hagrid, Boudicca and Merlin, and finally Thor, Freya and Loki. Freya has been a popular bird of prey name in the past. There are other raptors, I believe, of that name, but that was very much, that came through very strongly. So so there's four choices of three there for folk to make their choice on. I mean, there's no prize for it. It's a bit of fun, and try as we might, we just can't get the birds to come when they're called to their name, so it means nothing to the birds, I'm afraid, either. But I think it gives people a nice little bit of a connection to them. And I think it's nice that people have come up with things that are really, you know, marking our kind of lockdown summer and the people who've been prominent in that.
Tell us a story about the ghost pines. Well, two things. You don't want people to go to the site to see them because you physically can't see them, can you?
The best place to see these birds is on the camera. It's not the kind of wood. We don't have a visitor centre. It's a wild wood, and you can't approach the tree. During breeding season, you would be breaking the law, and it's not, you don't really get a good look at ospreys around the loch, because the couple of nests that there are, there's 12 miles of loch, and they go to the sea as well, so you can never predict where they're going to fish. So there are better places to go and see ospreys at visitor centres that are, you know, very well known. What we have at Loch Archaig Pine Forest is this amazing old pine wood that's been damaged over the years, and what we're trying to do is to restore it back to its full natural glory. But the history of it is quite extraordinary. It was the place where the commandos from many nations trained in World War II, French, British, Canadians, many others. And they had live firing exercises, and at various times during the war, the wood was set fire to. And the big one was 1942, and there was a flash fire right across the hillside, and what it did was it cooked these pines in their own resin, and it's actually preserved them. It's a really weird thing, so they're all still standing up, and they've gone white from being weathered over the time, and they're known as ghost pines. So you can, if you're on the other side of the loch and you look at the hillside, you'll see them right away along the forest, and actually the area where the nest is that the camera is on has got quite a few of these around about it. And our mother bird, Ayla, her favourite perch is actually in one of these ghost pines that's just behind the camera, so out of sight. So she quite often sits up there and she's watching a nest with the chicks in it from about 20 yards away or something like that. But they're really quite spooky looking. And it's the other thing we discovered when we did some survey work last year, is we've actually got a species there that is only there because of the fire, a lichen that only exists on burnt wood, that's never been found in the UK before. So it's amazing that history rattling down the years from the Second World War that's still visible in the landscape and has actually had an impact on the biodiversity.
Are they good parents?
They were terrible parents when we first encountered them. They were novices in 2017, and it was Lewis Pate, who's a ringer who advises on birds of prey, we being simple wood folk. He said it was miraculous that the chick Lachlan got away that year. It was his egg was left uncovered for, you know, days and nights, and they trampled all over the top of them, but nevertheless they managed. But they've been learning, and they are, I'd say they're now in their prime. They're reckoned to be about 7 years old, possibly 8 years old, and they're just parenting machines now. So Louis brought in over 300 fish in the season so far. There's not been a day when there's not been fish on the menu, and then one day he brought in 9, which was quite remarkable.
So basically they've got the hang of this now, George, and folk are still able to actually vote for these three names and still watch them on the cameras. George Anderson,
so they're going to be around for another couple of months before they migrate, the chicks and all of them. So we expect them possibly the next week to take their first flight, which will be brilliant. That's really great to watch.
Keep our eyes open for that, exactly. George Anderson, thanks you very much for your time.
I hope it's going to win as Ali Bali B, because we can play it next week as a contrast to Genesis.
You know what, I'm telling you, it's Hawkwind next week. We're going to go on now and reveal our tiny mystery bird. Lots of you getting this one, including Doug in Alness saying Wren. Barry Sutherland, our South Yorkshire ornithological correspondent, says mystery bird or wren, and goes on to say, my observations of this week, starlings are starting to murmurate. Counted 150 juveniles. Have you been noticing any up north? Seen lots of starlings, but no murmuration so far. Alan Reed from Inallen says, I think it's that wee warrior, the wren. Craig in Bearsden said, I think it's a blue tit. No, it's not, Craig. Evelyn Cook from Metallic says, the mystery bird is a wren. And Colin and Mary Abercrombie from Dunblane say, it's a wren. So, here's Mr. McElruth with some more info.
The wren, one of the country's most favourite birds. Well, not quite. In a recent poll, incredibly, it came fourth behind the barn owl, the kingfisher, and of course the robin. But they are delightful. Slightly bigger than the diminutive goldcrest, lovely dark markings on a soft coffee-coloured plumage, and the distinctive slash of white over the eyes, which highlights the fact that they're watching your every move. Because the wren, like no other bird, has a special relationship with mankind. Britain's most common bird seemingly has no fear of humans. And in countries across the world, to harm a wren or its chicks means serious bad luck, such as a broken leg, or even worse, coming your way. But not everyone was a fan of the bird. The early Christians regarded them as pagan, and it was claimed that a wren betrayed St. Stephen as he hid in a bush, and he paid the ultimate price for the wren's song, which exposed him. And every 26th of December, a wren was hunted and put on a pole to be taken round the village by wren boys celebrating Wren Day. It still goes on in the Isle of Man and some parts of Ireland, but now, thankfully, a fake bird adorns the pole. They are fiercely territorial during the summer months, but come winter, they face hard times as they have very little body fat, and sadly, many, many, many perish from the cold. But most survive by adopting the techniques used by penguins. As temperatures plummet, a male with spare room will advertise by making short, darting flights back and forward while calling to males and females to join them for the winter. One nesting box in Norfolk was occupied by 60 wrens, all with their heads looking inwards to share body heat. And not only does it help survival, the host male then has access to a number of females once things heat up. They'll eat a range of foods, including spiders and insects, but unlike many birds, they're not afraid of getting wet. A close cousin of the dipper, they can be seen getting into the shallows to take water insects and the odd tadpole or two. But the thing that sets this bird apart from all others is its song. Nothing can sing like a wren. And it's so small for such a huge sound. So how do they do it? Well, there's a special organ called the syrinx, about the size of a raindrop, which has a resonating chamber and membrane which can access almost every bit of air in the lungs, and it's evolved to produce two notes at the same time. Humans don't have a similar organ. They make sound through the larynx, which uses just 2% of the air in the lungs, which is why the wren is so loud. And finally, back to that relationship with humans. Come winter, wrens will come through an open door or a window and seek the dark corners of your house on the hunt for overwintering butterflies, such as peacock or tortoise shell, leaving only a cluster of broken wings across the floor. And finally, the legend of the wren, the king of birds. A similar tale exists about the goldcrest, but in this story, the birds of the world gather to see who could fly the highest and become king. The hot money, of course, was on the eagle, which soared higher and higher till it was out of sight. And then, when it was exhausted and could go no further, it paused, hung in the air, And of course, out pops the wren from under the feathers and flies just that little bit higher to claim the title. The wren, a bird to put a smile on your face.
Troglodytes, troglodytes, the cave dweller, and more avian fun next week.
Hey, yeah, you know, we should be in the curriculum for excellence in this programme. It's just so informative. Bill Stratton got in touch, said a big surprise a couple of days ago while driving near Bankery. A massive bird was being chased by a buzzard and it swooped down on my car and I just swerved away in the nick of time. And I looked up at the aerial dogfight and I couldn't believe my eyes. It was an enormous crane flapping and swooping and swerving to evade the buzzard. Fantastic.
I would have liked to have seen that. You know, you mentioned in your piece that, you know, the wrens nick an idea from penguins. There's an association here. Kath from the Falkland Islands came in and said, is the mystery bird a wren? Yes, Kath, it is. Andy in Inverness says, one of the biggest reasons giant hogweed has expanded so much was the push to fence off livestock from all watercourses. Sheep and cattle used to keep it under control has been one of the side effects of our attitude to conservation. This was done a lot in the Deveron and Ugi, which is why so much is seen here. Sue and Steve in Strathdon, this is interesting, say, morning, we have a leveret, as you know, it'll be called Kenny, Kenny Leveret, who nibbles, that's brilliant, who nibbles delicately in the garden as opposed to the ravages of the exponentially increasing bunny population. Ian and Dougal in Carron Valley says, could it be a wren? This week the recording's quite faint and difficult to hear over the noise of our footsteps as we're out walking in the Carron Valley Forest and Reservoir. It is heaven on earth. Always take my wee tranny to hear the show. And John and Rothy says, good morning, gentlemen, from a sunny Rothy. The boss says your wee birdie is a wren. Lord help us if she's wrong. Well, you're all right. She's right, John. No bother at all. Yeah. And that's this week's Scotland Outdoors podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. If you get the chance or the opportunity, you can like us or rate us on whichever podcast site you actually use, because that gives other people the chance to find us, and the more the merrier as far as we're concerned. Until the next time, thanks for listening.